decline, but that last year's level is still far below what it was in 2007.
It could take us another 5 years or so to return to pre-recession giving levels. So that's the really sobering reality here.
She said one bright spot, giving to arts groups grew almost 6%. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
A Nebraska nuclear plant has been spared by floodwaters from the Missouri River. Yesterday, the river topped 900 feet above sea level at Brownville, but it was still 18 inches shy of what was required to force the plant's shutdown. The Cooper nuclear site is said to be operating at full capacity. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Broad Superintendents Academy, preparing senior executives to become superintendents in urban school districts. Learn more at broadacademy.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, now on Route 45 in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future. It's part of what makes a Subaru. Information online at SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700. WILO programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. I'm David Inge. Harriet Williamson is our producer. The following program comes from the Focus archive, so that means that for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls. Our guest for this hour, Deb Fallows, has spent a lot of her life traveling around the world and learning languages. In fact, her academic training is in linguistics. She has a PhD in linguistics from Harvard. She says, though, nothing really in her past experience prepared her for the surprises involved in learning China's most common language, Mandarin. She writes about this in a recently published book that she titles Dreaming in Chinese, Mandarin Lessons in Life, Love, and Language. It's published by Walker and Company. And in the book, she explains that she, in trying to learn the language dealing with that struggle and that challenge, she picked up a number of clues that helped her better understand China and the Chinese people and Chinese culture. And we'll talk about that with her in this hour of the show. She's been good enough to spend some time with us. And Ms. Fallows, hello.
Yes, hi.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks, David. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. You spent 3 years there in China, 2006 to 2009. You went there with your husband, who should be familiar name and voice, actually, even to people who listen to public radio. Jim Fallows writes for The Atlantic. So you went there because he was going to be there. So you apparently decided that you would do everything you could to try to get yourself ready, and reading a lot about China and so forth. And you even went as far as to go and start taking lessons, start learning Chinese. And then you went, knowing that you really weren't ready, dealt with the challenge of being there. So one of the things you write about, I think, in the book is that in spite of this time that you had spent trying to learn Chinese, when you got there, you found out you couldn't understand anything that anybody was saying, at least in Shanghai, where you landed first.
That is unfortunately true. Yeah, you're right. When we decided to go to China, I've always been kind of ground control for our family. We've spent about half of our life living in other countries and half of it in Washington. So we were pretty familiar with the routines and the process of moving to a foreign place, of even very foreign places like Japan, where we spent a couple years. And I did study Mandarin for about a year at Georgetown, which is just down the street from us here in Washington, D.C., at their night and continuing education classes. So, but we knew that China was going to be such a big experience that whatever preparations we did would not leave us very much farther along than when we started. But I'll tell you, after a lifetime of studying languages and studying about languages, which is pretty much the study of linguistics, I was really taken aback with my first experience when we landed in Shanghai. I've never quite had an experience like that before of not understanding a single word of what was being spoken at me at that point, and kind of freezing up so that I couldn't say anything in this Mandarin that I'd been practicing for about a year. It was so bad that I even wondered if our teacher, his name was Meng Lao Shi, teacher is how you say it, at Georgetown had been teaching us Cantonese instead of Mandarin. But, you know, Cantonese is the dialect of Hong Kong and largely spoken in southern China, and Mandarin is the lingua franca throughout mainland China. And they are not intelligible. Cantonese speakers and Mandarin speakers cannot understand each other. I subsequently kind of calmed down from this experience and realized that there were a couple things going on. One is that in Shanghai, as in many places throughout China, the local dialect is spoken by a lot of the people, including the taxi drivers in Shanghai. And the local Shanghaiese dialect is a completely different language family from Mandarin. It's like as different as German to English. So there was no way I was going to understand that. And furthermore, like the U.S., China is a collection of lots of different regional accents. And my Beijing teacher, Meng Lao Shi, had a very kind of classic Beijing accent, which if you've heard any Chinese, it's recognizable as having that kind of pirate R sound at the end of many words, sure. Mm-hmm. And in Shanghai, they have a really kind of lolling southern accent. So it was different, say, from Boston accents to accents in Houston, Texas, or Atlanta, Georgia. And the whole sound register of a bunch of the different sounds in the language shifts from one to the other. So it took a really long time to kind of get used to the accent of Shanghai, but was good preparation for all of the rest of our travels around China, where the accents shifted regionally even more, I would say, than they do here, and dialects shifted regionally as well.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that, for example, if somebody who was a native speaker of English, if you went to try to learn a language like Spanish or Italian or French or German, you know, it would be challenging, but somehow the sounds that your ear would have to be tuned to are not so radically different. But it sounds as if the problem with learning Chinese is that, in fact, that is the problem. That is, your ear is just not tuned to those sounds like it would be as if you had spent your entire life hearing people around you speaking Chinese.
Yeah, that's true. And Chinese is kind of a good news, bad news situation. And we should mention the good news, because there's a lot of bad news in trying to struggle with the language. The good news is that there's a really simple grammar, so you don't have to force yourself to do all the kinds of things you do with Latin or Germanic or Romance languages, where you have to study all the endings, all these sets of endings that go on the verbs and the nouns, and make everything agree according to gender a lot of time, and change verb tenses. Mm. Chinese is just really straightforward in that sense. There's none of that rigmarole of heavy-duty grammar. But as you say, the sound system is really a bear for us. And there are a couple reasons for this. One is that the whole inventory of the sounds, for example, around the S and SH and Z and CH, like sh, sh, j, sh, ch, I'm not sure how well that's coming across on the radio, but there are lots more variations of those sounds that we simply don't have in English, mm-hmm. that are critical to making differences among the words. Like sh and xie are two completely different words, and it's hard for us to hear the distinction between those kind of sh sounds. So hearing those and trying to reproduce those is really a challenge and takes some getting used to before you get traction on it. The other thing that happens, of course, and is probably the most notorious thing about Chinese, is the tones. We don't have tones on words in English, so we're not used to paying close attention to those tones to making a difference. Like the word, if we said the word, let's pretend this is a Chinese word, him. H-I-M, him. Mm-hmm. If you say him, those all have different meanings in Chinese. So it's really hard for us to listen to those tonal differences to recognize them, to reproduce them, and to try to remember which meaning of that word goes with which tone. So you've got a lot of brain action going on in trying to absorb all these differences that are so alien to us all the time.
Yeah.
And I think for people who don't speak a tonal language, and incidentally, there are more languages in the world that have tones than don't, but of course ours doesn't, so it's extremely alien to us. Until you get into the idea of that, it's really a stopper for people learning the language.
And it sounds that as if there's really, for some of these things, the kind of thing that you're talking about, there's maybe different people who are trying to learn the language have different ways to try to do this, but it sounds as if you can't really quite intellectualize it in a way. You just have to memorize it, and that again, that's the kind of thing that just comes with speaking it a lot and hearing it spoken a lot. And I'm sure that just takes time and practice, and that the only way that probably happens is if you do have the opportunity to be immersed in it and be immersed in it for a while.
Well, I've done my own unscientific survey about this, which is basically asking everybody who's studying Chinese or teaching Chinese, how do you do it? What's your secret? How do you try to learn these tones and remember them? And there are lots of different theories out there and lots of different practices by teachers. And I had teachers who did lots of different things. Some would, a really common thing that teachers do is kind of use hand motions to signal, like, your arm is rising when you're learning a new word with a rising tone, or you're kind of genuflecting or going down and up when you're learning a word that's connected with a falling rising tone. So these classes become very aerobic, and I guess the idea is that if you can have other sensory connections to an actual word, you're more likely to learn and remember it. But really, I think you're right. What it comes down to is just hearing something over and over and over again until it kind of sounds right. The same way people are probably more used to learning Romance languages where you have gender on certain words. And if you're studying French, you know, you can try to memorize the les and las. And it's like multiplication tables. It's all arbitrary, and you just memorize it. You don't kind of go through the intellectualizing of, okay, what is 7 times 8? You have to do it really quickly. So it's just practice, practice, practice. And I think my best teachers were, and the ones who just were repetitive so many times that eventually it kind of sounds right. And I guess, you know, there's one other thing about tones. Even though it's really critically important to have the right tone and the right word, a lot of people would, even Chinese people kind of say, yeah, they agree with this, that what's really important here in the communication of Chinese is that you land on the right tone on the word that's most critical in the sentence. You know, if you're talking about that you want to go out and have a coffee, you have to say coffee with the right tone, but you can use there's a lot of context around that, so you can kind of fill in the other, what's this person likely to be saying? Do you want to, or is it or something completely different? So you can slide over some of the tones and make some mistakes in words that you're saying if you've got enough context built around it that you get the critical word right. But even that, you know, leaves a lot of possibility for error and mistake.
Well, that also, I do also wonder, even with native speakers of Chinese, whether there are times when people are talking and someone has to stop the other person and say, wait a minute, do you mean this or do you mean this? Does that actually happen?
That actually happens, but it's not really a question of, it's not really the fault of tones, because interestingly, tones are just so ingrained in Chinese. Often they won't really even be able to talk about tones. It's like it's such an integral part of the word that you can't separate it from the sounds of the words. But what happens in the case when what you're saying is that the language also has so many homonyms, and this is going back again to the sound system of the language, that in English we have 4,000 different syllable structures. And a syllable where you get, say, a vowel in the middle and then a bunch of consonants at the beginning or the end, like the word stretch. STRETCHED. You got the S, T, R, and then the S sound, and then the T, CH, or CH, and D at the end. So we have so many different words that have so many different sounds available to them that we don't end up with a problem that Chinese does, which is have so many homonyms. Because in Chinese, as opposed to our 4,000 syllables, there are only 400 possible syllables. It's just consonant, vowel, like ma, ta, shir, hu, wo, wo. And with that small an inventory of syllables to work with, the result is that you get homonyms all over the place. Like, going back to that word him, we have him sounding the same, spelled different, but him as in he and him, and him as in him to sing the church song, the hymn. Mm. But in Chinese, there are, if you open your dictionary to a random word like sure, you might find 12 pages of words that sound like sure but have different meanings. So, and that holds for, so the tones go a long way towards distinguishing one word from another that sounds the same, but not far enough. There are still all kinds of homonyms left over where a word like sh can have six or eight different meanings for exactly the same sound of words. So the Chinese are themselves, you know, always having to clarify back and forth. Well, did you mean him as in church song, or did you mean him as in he?
Mm. It's fascinating. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Deborah Fallows, and she is the author of a book that's about her experiences living in China and learning about China and also learning Mandarin. The title of the book is Dreaming in Chinese, Mandarin Lessons in Life, Love, and Language. Walker & Company is the publisher. It just came out last fall. She's lived a lot of places around the world, including Shanghai and Beijing. She traveled throughout China for 3 years with her husband, James Fallows, a writer. She's a linguistic by her academic training, and she's talking with us about the experience. And questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Here is a caller, someone who's been waiting patiently on line one. We'll get right to them. Right here, line one. Hello.
Is that me?
Yes.
Yeah, the guy didn't give me the line number. So anyway, well, ni hao.
Ni hao.
This is an interesting coincidence because I'm leaving tomorrow for a two-week trip to Shanghai. But I guess the reason I'm calling is because I wanted to get your insight is into some of the vexing and stubborn problems I have with my Chinese students speaking and particularly writing English. And I guess it's questions like, how does the Chinese language handle prepositions? Let me just give you two examples. If I said the apple fell from the tree, and in a second sentence, the tree fell on the apple, how would those translate into Chinese, and would they translate into Chinese in a way that you could distinguish between the two of them?
The first thing that makes English and Chinese speakers have to do a kind of backward somersault when they're learning the other language is that the preposition goes on the wrong side. We say on the tree, but they would say the tree on. So you have to move around the word order of those, which isn't so bad. You know, it's just one little rule that you can say. I'm trying to think of this particular example. The apple fell from the tree. Well, that this is a funny thing because the prepositions, there's a lot of other things that are a bit quirky. And you know, if you say, like, the book is on the table or the book is under the table, that should be no problem. It's really straightforward. You have a preposition that means on top of, and you have a preposition that means underneath. Mm-hmm. And the only thing you have to remember is to push that around to the end of the phrase. So it's the table on top or the table underneath.
Okay.
And that's pretty straightforward. But there's a little bit of a quirk in the apple falling from the tree, because you're really talking about that the tree owns this apple, and it's like the tree's apple fell.
Okay.
In what we call the possessive, it's the tree, comma, the tree, apostrophe S, the tree's apple, or like the boy's hat or the girl's book. So it would be the tree's apple fell rather than the apple fell from the tree. They don't have that. There are so many exceptions that have to be used, and that particular one might just be a little bit problematic because of the semantics of how you assign that apple to the tree.
Okay. Well, that was just an example, but it's those are the kinds of
But there are lots of examples that are like that, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, but at any rate, there are prepositions in Chinese, is what you're saying.
Yes.
And there are Chinese characters for those prepositions. Is that correct?
Yes, there are.
Okay.
Yes, yes is the answer.
Okay.
So maybe there's something else going on here.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. You've helped me some. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We will continue, and we'll talk next with someone in Urbana. This is line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Good morning.
Hi.
Yeah, I have a question about this homonym problem in Chinese. I find it curious why a language would evolve if a particular, you know, what we would call a word could have so many different meanings, and people have to keep asking each other what they meant by this. It just doesn't seem logical that a language would evolve this way. And so if somebody has a news broadcast in Chinese and is just stalking any news broadcast, people are confused about what he's saying because they can't ask him what particular word he's referring to. I just don't quite understand this.
No, I love your question. And it was actually questions like that were some of the questions that made me so interested in this language. And because there are a number of things that Chinese does where you think, this just doesn't make sense. I've never seen a language to do something like this, and why should there be so many homonyms that go toward confusion rather than clarification, which is what language is supposed to do? You know, the idea is that you communicate with people in languages. So you're absolutely right, and it was one of the first questions that I came across, too, of why is this so confusing, and why is it confusing even to the native speakers? In this case, I think in general, okay, we can talk in general and in specific. And in general, Chinese has evolved in a way that's different from a lot of languages around the world because it was just isolated for such a long time. And usually, even when other people came wandering through China and so forth, it kind of followed a different path from a lot of other languages. Say if you run into people who through wars or through exploration or whatever it is historically that you run into, there's often a lot of borrowing back and forth between languages. And Chinese, because it was so different in the sound system, in the structure from a lot of other languages it ran into, rather than borrow a lot of things from other languages, it kind of developed, it evolved from within its own language. So, for example, instead of borrowing words, like English borrowed so many words from the French, starting from the Norman invasion in 1066, that about half of our language now is based in French. Instead of doing that, when Chinese was evolving and needed to create new words for ideas or products or thoughts or concept or whatever it is, they would look within their own language and make compounds words out of little words that they already have, so that the development from we're talking a long time ago now, from a simple language to a more sophisticated language looked inward rather than looked outward and bringing other concepts into its own language. So a lot of the ways that Chinese developed was from this working within its own language rather than getting influence from other language. So that's kind of a general thing that happened that makes the result of Chinese end up different in a whole lot of ways from most other languages and how they evolved. In this specific case of homonyms, you're right, and I agree. It doesn't make any sense that it should be so hard to be like this. And historically, there are a couple things that happened. For reasons that don't really make sense, they used to have a lot more consonant clusters so that there wouldn't be so many homonyms in the language, but that was at a kind of more simple stage of language. And as it evolved, just for some reason, those clusters kind of fell out of use, and so you ended up with a lot of these simple consonant-vowel. And then to counteract the problem of getting so many homonyms, the tones came in as a solution, which is really smart because you can get a lot more leverage out of a single syllable if you have five different tones slapped onto it that all indicate something else. But as we say, still there's a lot of clarification that needed to happen. And so what happened was, one, people just have to kind of struggle with it, but two, you end up using a lot more context and padding around what you're saying, so that when you're saying things, you try to, when you kind of instinctively know that there could be an issue of double meaning or double entendre, to pad that with the words around it and the phrases around it and the context around it, so that your meaning will be more or less clear. But it's an imperfect system, and it just doesn't work all the time. And I wish, you know, I wish I had a better, I don't think there is a better explanation for this.
Yeah,
it's just a tough thing.
So on a news broadcast on the radio, people will be confused about what's being said, or the
No, it's not really that bad because in a news broadcast, you say, okay, we're going to be talking about Osama bin Laden now. So your brain kind of is in the topic of what's going on.
Yeah.
And if you hear a word that's a homonym, like say the word assault has two different meanings, you know which meaning of assault we're going to be here.
Yeah.
It's going to be in that kind of context. So it happens much less in that kind of verbal exchange or dictation or, you know, broadcast than it does in casual conversations, where people are often very much more sloppy about the antecedents and when you jump around from topic to topic, and when you're referring to something that happened earlier without being clear about it. So, you know, casual conversation and colloquial conversation is much more kind of messy and unclear than is formal conversation, especially when everybody is on task or on the same page of the book, so to speak.
Yeah, and I guess you might point out that this is maybe one of the reasons why it uses a logographic system, because the written language is completely clear, regardless of the dialect. If they write it in pinyin, then you're running into the same kinds of ambiguities using the sounds, you know, just the sounds instead of the ideas represented by the symbols, the logographs.
That's right. Yeah, and that the debates over the centuries, well, or certainly more over the last 100 years, should these characters hang around or not? Because it is really hard to learn those characters, and the Chinese are always having to kind of keep current in characters and not get rusty about it if they've, say, been living out of the country for a while, or obscure words with difficult characters. But as you say, it's such a tool to the Chinese that everybody reads the same characters. I think the way to think about this is the numerals. So we use, you know, Arabic numerals. If you write a 4, everybody around the world can recognize that that's a 4. But we all have different ways of pronouncing that word for 4. It works the same thing with the Chinese, same way with the character system.
Right.
If you're a Cantonese speaker, a Shanghai dialect speaker, a Mandarin speaker, even a Japanese speaker, or pick, you know, any of the 50 dialects that are spoken around China, everybody can read the same characters. It will just sound different. And on TV, actually, all of the Chinese programs, the news broadcasts, here we are back to those, are a good example. Everything is subtitled with Chinese characters, so that people in Sichuan who speak the Sichuan dialect can listen to the Beijing Mandarin broadcaster and read what he's saying. If you get stuck on a word or if you get stuck on a homonym, you've got the character there to distinguish it, so you know what it will mean. So it's a complete visual aid and kind of rescue system for Chinese.
Yeah. In this hour of Focus, Deborah Fallows is the guest. She spent time living in various places around the world and learning languages. She has a PhD in linguistics from Harvard. And we are talking about some of her experiences learning Mandarin Chinese. She did that during the time that she lived, 3 years that she lived in Shanghai and Beijing, and has written about this in her book, Dreaming in Chinese. The subtitle is Mandarin Lessons in Life, Love, and Language, and it's published by Walker & Company. You know, I have to ask you, I imagine that there are people who have gone through an intensive experience trying to learn another language, and that they have said that there was a turning point for them when they actually started to dream in that language. So now I have to ask you, did you ever dream in Chinese?
I did dream in Chinese, but I must say, honestly, it was more of one of those nightmare dreams. You know that dream where you're running for the bus and you're just trying to get on the bus and the bus is about 2 feet in front of you, can never quite get onto it, get onto the step? It was one of those dreams where I could never quite get where I was going, which was, I think, a metaphor for our life in China. Anyway, it was yes, I did. Yeah. But, you know, back to that dreaming in the language, I also asked just about everybody I knew who was having experiences learning foreign languages, so did you dream in Chinese or did you dream in French or German, whatever it was? And I think the myth, and it's a bit of a myth, is that when you get to a certain level, you can dream in that language. But really, people's honest answers were across the board. A lot of people said, oh, I have no idea. I can never remember my dreams. Or I never really have a language when I dream. Or, yes, I'm absolutely sure that I do dream in that language because my mother-in-law is Chinese, and when I know when I talk to her in my dreams, I'm dreaming in Chinese, otherwise in English. Or others who said, yes, you know, when I was in the real throes of this immersion, I would dream in Chinese. So there's something to it, but I think it probably has more to do with the world of dreams and the world of foreign language learning, the world of an intense experience. You know, you dream about kind of whatever intense thing it is that you're in the middle of often.
Yeah. Well, I'm still having dreams where I'm across town and then realize I have to be on the air.
Oh.
And then of course, what do? I start to run as if I could run across town in the minute that I'm supposed to be on the air. So I still have anxiety dreams related to missing deadlines. I think everybody in this business does.
At least it doesn't matter if you show up in your pajamas, though. You can.
True enough. That's right. I'm wearing my pajamas right now. No,
right.
I'm not. I'm sure also that people who come to another language, a lot of people will have the experience of saying that they're trying to, that there's something that they're speaking to a person, trying to speak to a person in this other language. And there is something that they would like to say that they, in their native language, could say quite comfortably. There would be no difficulty in saying that. And then they realize that in this second language that they're trying to learn and achieve some mastery in, that there's actually no way to say what it is they can say in their first language. And sometimes I think that turns out to be very revealing about the culture and the people of the second language. Is there some particular example like that where you say something that we would easily be able to express in English, you would try to say that in Chinese and you realize, no, there's just no way to say that?
Okay, I'm going to fudge a little bit on this because I can't remember right now the examples, but there were things like that, and often they were surprisingly simple. Like you'd be having a conversation about maybe a book or an idea, like Tiger Mothers. That was always, we've just come back from another 2 months in China, so I was asking a lot of people about Tiger Moms, and that gets to be a pretty thick topic. But then you suddenly realize you can't do something like say, oh, where did I put my shoes? Or just something as simple as that. Here's a different kind of answer to what you're saying, and it's more about a misunderstanding than about not being able to find what are the right words for it. I had this sense, and this gets more into the part of the book where the language helps you understand what's going on in the culture, which was my lifesaver here, because both of them were so hard to penetrate. But I had often this experience toward the beginning when I was starting to learn Chinese that I was often feeling like I was being offensive or abrupt, even to the point of rude when I was speaking Chinese, that I would overcompensate. I would say, you know, pleases and thank yous all over the place. If somebody says, well, would you like a, if the waiter says, would you like a glass of water, I'd say in Chinese, oh, no, thank you. Or in English, you'd say, oh, no, thank you, not right now. I'll have some later. Thanks very much. But in Chinese, you just say, buyao, which means don't want. And as a new Chinese speaker, you want to kind of finish that off with all the politeness that surrounds it, like at least, xiexie, buyao. No thanks, you know, I don't want it. But nobody in Chinese ever says xiexie. They just say the don't want part. So when my sense of speaking Chinese was that I knew that I was only supposed to say don't want. I knew I wasn't supposed to say the pleases and the thank yous and the kind of softeners. And whenever I would insert them, I was sounding like a really funny oddball kind of speaker. On the flip side, if we were at a table in a restaurant and the table next to us was filled with a family or fine friends or whatever, you'd be having very polite behavior at the table, serve the others, pour drinks for the others before you pour yourselves. And then in the midst of that, say one person would say to the person next to them, the gei wo yan, which is the equivalent of give me the salt, not please pass the salt or may I have the salt please, or would you please pass the salt. It was just give me the salt. And knowing that that was right, you know, it was really hard to say that as an English speaker of just give me the salt when you knew it was right, because you did feel very abrupt or rude. And in fact, the great linguistic, sociolinguistic explanation of this is that in Chinese, when you insert these softeners, the pleases and the thank yous and would yous and could yous, that actually serves to to put a kind of distance between you and the person that you're talking to. So if I say to my good friend, would you please pass the salt, her interpretation would be, why are you saying please to me? You know, you're treating me like someone who is very formal to you. We're best friends here, and it even offends me, and I certainly don't understand it, that you're saying please pass the salt when you just should be saying pass the salt. So that difference in how language works with respect to protocol and behavior and politeness is completely different in Chinese and in English. And it takes a while to believe it as a speaker of the other language that you're supposed to leave out all the softeners when you're speaking Chinese. And that's the proper and polite, actually, and familial way to do it.
That's really very interesting that we would have this idea that these little courtesies, these little linguistic courtesies are something that's nice, and particularly if it's something that someone who is close to you, you express your regard for them by putting those things in, where the Chinese would say that we're so close, you and I, we don't need that kind of thing. You don't need to do that thing with me. And then, in fact, they would say that sort of exaggerated courtesy is the kind of thing that you put into an interaction with a stranger. And that if you use that with me, it would be like, well, why are you treating me like somebody you don't really know?
Yes. You said it better than I did. That's exactly right. And it takes, you know, you can understand that intellectually. Okay, that's just, it's the different systems. And it's, you know, one of the things that makes for communication between the Chinese and non-Chinese a difficult thing until you get over it and kind of can really absorb it beyond intellectualizing it to actually.
Something that's an issue, I think, for some people in some places and not for others is introduced words. That is, if you need a word for something new, rather than trying to take your own language and seeing, can I make up a word that'll mean this? Some people say, well, there's no problem with that. I'll use the other word. And probably in a lot of languages, the borrowed in words are English. And that there are some places, like the French, for example, they have a thing about French, and they're not really cool on introduced words in Chinese. How are they? Are there people in Chinese that end up using English words because there's no good Chinese word for that, or do they try to do like the Germans do and they actually put together words and they make up words to take the role of that word that doesn't exist?
Yeah, this is one of the lovely things about Chinese, I think, that helps you kind of look into the soul of the Chinese. They don't borrow words from other languages, and it hasn't been their pattern, and partly because it's hard actually to pronounce a lot of the foreign words, because we're back to this sound system and consonant clusters and very simple syllables. So the pattern in Chinese has been to make up new words based on their own language, and it often gives you, it's just wonderful as a language learner, because there are actually, it makes it easier in some senses. There are certain patterns, like quite a long time ago, say the word for height, like as in how tall is someone. In way back in the time before we needed or they needed a word for height, there were the words, say, that meant tall and short, gao and ai, tall, short. So instead of borrowing a new word or making up a completely different kind of word, they put together, made a compound word out of two opposites words, tall, short, and you come up with the concept of height, which is a really nice kind of visual language aid. And there are a whole bunch of words in Chinese that work like that. Like the word for switch is on-off. So will you on-off the light? And then they're very easy to remember. In, say, contrast Japanese and Chinese. Japanese loves to borrow words. And, for example, you have a word like computer, computa, in Japanese. In Chinese, they have made up a new word, which is wonderful. The first part of the word is dian, which means electric. And the second part of the word is brain, nao. So dianao is electric brain, which is a computer. And I bet you'll remember that tomorrow, you know. It's one of those words. And so the same thing with, you can learn patterns, and it's great for teaching you a whole bunch of words, vocabulary words that are related, like elevator is electric steps. And let's see. I'm trying to think of some others. TV is electric vision or something like that. So you get words in compounds made up in that way. So Chinese is, it does give you some ways to look into the soul of Chinese to think, okay, how did they decide to call this an electric brain for a computer? I'm sure as time marches along, there will be more borrowing of foreign words into Chinese. You know, China has opened up now, and lots more people are learning English, and you get lots more exposure to foreign languages in China than you did back in the day. So, and especially with Internet use, where a lot of things get abbreviated, naturally a lot more strange things are coming into the language and bringing in, say, abbreviations or much more exposure to a certain group of foreign words. So I think it's inevitable that there will be more influence from foreign languages onto Chinese than there has been in the past. But it's really remarkable, and one of the amazing things about Chinese is how, in a way, purist it is compared to most other languages.
You talked a little earlier about Chinese being a tonal language, and about the advantages that can come with that, and about how that for someone who didn't grow up hearing Chinese and speaking Chinese, that can be a difficult thing. And you, in the book, you helpfully have a pronunciation guide here to help people sound out the Chinese words that are in here. Having said that, though, I find myself thinking about the fact that here, over time, there have been two major systems developed for trying to represent the sounds of Chinese using the Roman alphabet. There was one that was a system for a long time, the older one, and then there was a more recent one that I guess some people thought was slightly better. The problem with both of them, I think, is it's still kind of arbitrary that certain letters have come to represent certain sounds, and it still, to me, still doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Some things, why? And it may just be a matter you just have to memorize that certain letters go with a certain sound. I wonder, and maybe this goes back to the business of the tones, why it is that we've no one has ever been able to come up with a better way of trying to represent the sounds of Chinese using the Roman alphabet.
Yeah, and they have tried. There have been a bunch of attempts to do this. I'm actually pretty much a fan of Pinyin, which is the current Roman alphabet system for writing Chinese. And so this goes back really to a lot of the phonetics of the sound system. You've got sounds that aren't, in order to really accurately render the sounds of a Chinese word into a Roman alphabet, you need a bunch of little kind of markers. Like, it's not exactly in the word xia, X-I-A.
Mm-hmm.
It means down or under or underneath. It's very hard for us to distinguish sha and xia because they sound pretty much the same. But actually, that X sound is articulated in your mouth in a very different way from the sh sound, xia and sh. And what happens is the tongue is pushed much farther forward to your mouth. So Pinyin came up with the solution of using an X there for the xia. But when we look at that X, we don't know quite what to do with it,
uh-huh,
and can pronounce it a really different way. And if we'd have to use actually a much more complicated kind of technical phonetic rendering than a simple Roman alphabet can use. And you can help it by putting the I after it, because your tongue wants to go there toward the front of the mouth if an I comes after it. But it's that our simple Roman alphabet doesn't adequately cover the splicing of some of these S and SH sounds that you need for Chinese. It doesn't do it really well, but it does it pretty well. And I actually think it does it better than most people think.
Yeah.
If you look for clues like the I after the X rather than a different kind of vowel after an SH sound. This is kind of a more technical explanation than people want to hear. But the other reason that so I guess we can say it's an imperfect system. On the other hand, look at English spelling. We don't do so well with that either.
Well, yes.
Right? Over time.
Yes.
So who are we to cast stones in this case? English spelling is actually worse than Pinyin spelling, which is a better, I would argue, is just a better, follows the pronunciation better than English spelling follows pronunciation. But the Pinyin helps a whole lot in one modern sense, which is use of keyboards. You're not going to have a keyboard full of characters. You have a keyboard with our Roman letters, and you start to type out the word in Pinyin. And then when you get far enough, a couple of characters will pop out and let you choose from what that character is. And then you can click onto that character, and there it appears on the screen. So Pinyin does drag the language or help push the language into the modern era of using typewriters and using computers.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're just about at the point where I'm really sorry to say we have to finish. Maybe we have about a minute or so, and I'm sure that having learned any language, your facility develops as you use it. But if you don't, it starts to melt away. Do you still find ways to use your Chinese?
Well, luckily we have a great Chinese station on our cable network, and anybody who has a computer. And the internet has actually no excuse anymore not to try to keep up with it, because you can always do lessons and listen to watch video clips or listen to audio clips and so forth. But it's hard when you're not in the context of it all the time. One thing that is heartening here, so we'd been back from China for about 8 months and then went back again for a visit, and I was terrified after all this long struggle that it would be completely gone. But I think maybe this time it works better. Like, the harder you struggle, the more struggle you put into it, the more slowly it disappears.
Mm-hmm.
I was surprised that it came back to me after I had a brain rest for 8 months as well as it did.
Well, so, just one of the, I mentioned at the beginning that you had a PhD in linguistics. Did it, being a linguist, did that help at all?
I think it helps it helps adults, because I could look at this language and kind of understand what was going on with the grammar or with the sound system. That for me, it worked because, you know, spending so much time in the structure of language and how language works, I could say, oh, here's the problem. Sh and sh are actually different. So I just have to learn that it's, you know, the point of articulation of that particular sibilant is in the forward part of the mouth. To me, that made sense. So it helped working through some of these oddities of the grammar a whole lot easier for me, or the grammar or the sound system.
Mm-hmm.
But to fully translate that kind of intellectual explanation into functional daily use is, it doesn't, you know, you just kind of, you can understand it intellectually, but then employing it, you have to go through as much work as everybody else does to make it usable, or at least I did.
All right, there we'll have to leave it. Deborah Fallows is our guest. The book is Dreaming in Chinese, Mandarin Lessons in Life, Love, and Language, published by Walker & Company. And Ms. Fallows, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, David.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois. Donated blood saves the lives of the injured and critically ill. There are no substitutes for donated blood, and donation takes only 45 minutes. Blood donation, it's about life. More information is on the web at bloodservices.org.
At 3 minutes before 12 o'clock, I'm Tom Rogers. I'll be the host of the Afternoon Magazine in place of Celeste Quinn today. We'll have our roundup of news from BBC, the local news from Illinois Public Media and NPR coming up in the next hour. Right now, let's take a look at the commodity markets. The wheat trade is still falling. Technical selling has accelerated a drop triggered by seasonal pressure in the U.S. harvest, but the corn has risen of late after some early weakness. The U.S. dollar index has eased earlier strength, briefly lifting crude oil prices and prompting some short covering, according to traders. Let's take a look at how prices are faring right now. And we see the Kansas City July wheat contract down 5.25 cents, 5.75 cents now at 7.98 3/4. September contract at 8.17, down 5.25 cents, and December 8.41 1/2, down 4.5. In Chicago, on the Board of Trade, the July wheat contract is down a dime at 6.62 1/4. September is down 10 cents at 6.98 a bushel. December 7.48, down 5.25. Corn actually is mixed at the moment. The nearby July is up 1.5 cents, now up at 1.75 cents at 7.02. The September is down 3/4 cents at 6.86 1/4. And December, new crop corn is down 1.75 cents at 6.58 1/4. The March contract down 1.25 cents at 6.70 1/2. Crude oil down another 32 cents a barrel at 92.69. RBOB gasoline is at 2.92 3/10. That's down 2 3/10. July soybeans right now standing up 9.5 cents a bushel at 13.42 1/2. The August up 9.5 at 13.43. September beans are at 13.40 1/4, up 7.5 cents. November 13.42 1/4, up 9. January 13.52 1/2, up 9 3/4. In the products, July soybean meal at 3.52.30. That's up 3.30. And August at 3.52 even, up 3.50. July bean oil at 56.20, up 28. August at 56.48, up 29. On the Chicago Mercantile Exchange livestock side, the June live cattle contract is right now at 111.90. That's up 2.15 a hundredweight. August at 112 even, up 180. Feeder cattle for August at 135.60. That's up 2.95. And September up 237.5 at 135.95. July lean hogs are currently at 97.60. That's up 195 a hundredweight. August at 96.47.5, up 162. Looking at some of the outside markets, including the stock market, the Dow is currently up about 67 points at 12,071. The NASDAQ is at 2,632. That's up almost 16 points. And the S&P 500 index is up 6.75 at 1,278. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. Our next market update comes up at 12:58. And remember, you've got the closing market report coming.